Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels' family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
Back in about February of last year, we tackled 6 topics in 1 episode, and they were all things that people had asked us to talk about. But for one reason or another, we couldn't really make a whole standalone episode out of each of them. People seem to really like that one. We called it 6 Impossible Episodes.
Yeah.
And so about 6 months later, we did 6 more Impossible Episodes, which were similarly things people had asked us to talk about that we couldn't really do a whole show on. And both of those times, the biggest culprit was just a lack of information. Either there's not a lot actually known about what was being requested, or not a lot of information available to us, or in some cases, just not quite enough to make a whole 30-minute story out of. So people seem to like that one too. And if we follow that basic 6 months or so pattern, we're basically a little bit overdue for another 6 Impossible Episodes. So we're doing one today. And today's has a little bit of a different theme. These are all subjects people have asked us to talk about, and they are impossible, not just for an overall lack of information, although that is sometimes true, but also because the events and the people themselves, or the reason that the people have asked us to talk about it, might not ever have actually happened. So this is like possible apocrypha. We're using the more casual meaning of apocrypha there, not the religious meaning of apocrypha.
Yeah, in some of these cases, there's lots of information, but none of it is corroborated.
Right. Yeah. And in some cases, we are going to talk about one thing that actually really did for sure happen, but the reason that people ask us to talk about it did not happen.
First up, we're going to talk about the Battle of Carrancebes. We don't know 100% if we are accurate on that pronunciation, but that is the way it was heard in research. So this shows up on a lot of lists of weird military history or most absurd battles ever fought. It shows up in books about military blunders, you know, things like that. And it's the kind of story people pull out to try to illustrate purported military incompetence.
Yeah, if somebody wants to basically make the military the butt of a joke, this is one of the stories that people will trot out. And the basic gist of it is that in 1788, Austria and Russia were both at war with the Ottoman Empire. And that fall, according to the story, the Austrian army fell victim to an enormous friendly fire incident in which 10,000 troops were killed, and that is what is known as the Battle of Caransebees.
And here is how the history of the 18th century and of the 19th till the overthrow of the French Empire, with particular reference to mental cultivation and progress, which was a piece printed in 1845, describes this situation. According to that text, the Austrian army was en route to take up a new position near the town of Caransebees. Then, quote, on the march thither, the army was seized with a most unaccountable panic, believed themselves to be threatened by the enemy, fell into disorder, and mistook their own troops from the Sclavonian frontier for enemies. The regiments fired upon one another, looked everywhere for an enemy where in reality there was none, and all attempts on the part of the emperor in person to stop the firing and put an end to the confusion were in vain.
So the emperor in question who appeared in person was Holy Roman Emperor Joseph II. And according to the story, he had gotten separated from the rest of the fighting force, and he sort of came upon this melee with only one attendant with him. Sometimes in some retellings of the story, in the whole kerfuffle, he was knocked off of his horse into a river.
And in some versions of the story, the cause of this chaos in which the army attacked itself was a peddler, or perhaps a camp of Roma, selling schnapps or some other alcohol. Some scouts on patrol bought and consumed a great deal of this schnapps, and then apparently on a lark, built some fortifications for themselves and their imbibing. And when another group of Austrian infantry approached, the inebriated scouts thought they were the enemy. Shots were exchanged, and things escalated from there.
The Ottoman Empire's army purportedly stumbled onto the scene of the incident a couple of days later, and then they found the bodies of about 10,000 men. And with the bulk of this fighting force out of the way, the Ottoman Empire captured the city of Caransebees with basically no resistance.
There are just so many reasons to question this incident. Number one, information about it is incredibly sparse, which seems kind of unlikely if 10,000 people were actually killed by their own side. Number two, the written record on it doesn't seem to start until more than 50 years after this event supposedly took place. And this is particularly weird considering that the emperor, who lived until February 20th of 1790, was purportedly there. That source we read from earlier points back to Austrian Military Magazine of 1831, which is an incredibly vague citation.
A lot of the more modern retellings of the story, like lists on the internet that people pass around about military ridiculousness, really seem to be drawn from an old version of the current Wikipedia article. So that would have been the version that existed back when these lists and things were written. And that version presents it as a completely factual event that definitely happened. It also cites no sources. Illustrates one of the difficulties of citing Wikipedia as a source.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons we do not ever use it. It is a fun tool of the internet, but for us it is not really a verifiable enough source.
Yes. There are definitely good reasons, like there are great things about Wikipedia, but we do not use it as a source for our shows.
Yeah. And the most likely scenario is that there was some kind of confusing and chaotic friendly fire incident, but the odds are that it was not nearly at the scale that is reported in these various fantastical versions of the story.
Yeah, and I think probably something did happen, but not the thing that people like to use to prove a point that maybe doesn't even need to be proven. It really is one of the stories that people trot out to be like, and this is how the military wastes their money. And I'm like, this is not, you're not supporting your argument with this story that, like, Number one, even if it were true, it was hundreds of years ago and not in the nation whose military you're talking about. Anyway, so the next possibly apocryphal person is somebody a lot of people have asked us to talk about, and that is Tomoe Gozen. And she's really one of our most requested figures in Japanese history, and for good reason. She's described as this 12th century Japanese warrior woman. She was described as beautiful and fearless and an expert with both a sword and a bow, really highly skilled on horseback, and a little bit of a departure from what might be expected of her gender. She led men into battle. She's described in the epic the tale of Heka as, quote, prepared to confront both demons and gods, a warrior equal to 1,000 men. So she's really got a lot in common with a lot of other historical warrior women who we've talked about on the show, like Boudica and Zenobia and the Amazons of Dahomey.
Gozen is a title meaning young lady or young one, and there's enough historical information to suggest that there probably was a young woman named Tomoe involved in the Genpei War near the end of the Heian period in Japan. And we've talked about the Heian period in our previous episode on Seishonagon. It was what was happening in Japan at roughly the same time as the medieval period in Europe.
The Genpei War was between the Taira and the Minamoto clans. So the Minamoto clan's victory led it to establish the shogunate that would rule Japan from 1192 to 1333. Tomoe served in the army of General Kiso no Yoshinaka, who was part of the Minamoto clan. Between 1181 and 1184, she seems to have been present at least three battles, getting the better of 7 mounted warriors in the first one, commanding 1,000 warriors in the second, and beating a particularly fearsome opponent known as Onda no Hachiro Muroshige in the third.
A number of accounts suggest that she survived the war because Kizo no Yoshinaka, outnumbered and preparing to fight to the death, or possibly mortally wounded himself, ordered Tomoe to go, perhaps because it would have been considered shameful for him to die beside a woman, or perhaps because the outlook was so grim that her gender, which apparently had not been an issue before, suddenly was.
Otherwise, we really know very little about her. We don't know who her parents were, when or where she was born, whether she was married or had children, or what happened to her after the war was over. Different accounts of her life give wildly different information about all of this, including different ages at the time of the war, as well as different family connections, both as related to her parents or siblings, who she may or may not have been married to. All of that stuff is kind of a fog of contradictions.
And we don't even know in what capacity she wound up on the battlefield in the first place. There are some accounts that describe her as a female warrior or a female general, but others call her a servant, even a nun, or someone's mistress, among other descriptions. A lot of the sources that describe all these details are from later on in Japanese history, and many of them are definitely fictitious or at least embellished versions of the truth.
And a lot of the sources that write about her draw directly from the tale of the Heika, which really spent some time circulating as an oral history before it was ever written down. Some people draw comparisons between this epic and, like, the Iliad, and how the Iliad is, I mean, the Iliad has probable historical roots, but, like, we don't really read it as the history of what actually happened. So there are some comparisons between that and this epic where Tomoe Gozen was mentioned for the first time. Tomoe Gozen also became a character in many, many, many stories, both inside and out of Japan, that have gone on in all of the centuries since she was first mentioned in this poem.
And Kristen and Caroline from our sister podcast, Stuff Mom Never Told You, actually delved into this question a little bit in their August 2015 episode entitled Samurai Women.
A really interesting episode that I recommend you listen to if you want to learn more about this topic in general. As is the case with a lot of the things that we are talking about today, I have a feeling that there probably was a young woman known as Tomoe who was involved in some way, but the almost godlike stature that she has been given in later retellings, probably embellishment. We're going to talk about some more things after a sponsor break.
That sounds grand.
Including a really creepy thing that people ask us about every Halloween.
That I love.
Yes. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver. And this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
So, we get a lot of requests to talk about the terrifying cannibal Sawney Bean, especially around Halloween. I was sure the people in Scotland would probably say that differently, but then I watched videos of Scottish people talking about it, and they all said Sawney Bean. So, Sawney Bean is a really famous figure in Scotland, and according to the lore, Sawney Bean, more properly known as Alexander Bean, and his wife abandoned their home in East Lothian. They wound up living in a cave on the coast of Scotland, and there they turned to a life of cannibalism. They murdered travelers on a nearby road, then took them back to the cave, cooked them, and ate them.
And in a maneuver that sounds like something out of that super wonderful but also terrifying X-Files episode with the Peacock family, Sawney Bean and his wife, Black Agnes Douglas, had children, and their children intermarried among one another, forming an incestuous cannibal clan that terrorized the neighboring region for at least 25 years.
Supposedly, this all played out sometime in the 15th century, and when the king heard that people were going missing, thanks to somebody who actually escaped Sawney Bean's clutches, he sent soldiers to capture the whole group of them. The women and the children were put to death first by being burned at the stake, while the men were forced to watch, and then the men were themselves hanged.
And this story is really entrenched in Scottish folklore, especially in the southwestern part of the country around Ayrshire, where it allegedly all took place. And there are even tours to Sawney Bean's supposed cave for tourists and the fans of the grizzly.
But there's no evidence that any of this ever happened. There's no archaeological evidence of a family living in a cave and cooking and eating other people there. There are no royal records of a manhunt followed by a mass execution. There are no records of survivors saying their families had fallen victim to cannibals on the road in that part of Scotland. And even though it all supposedly happened around the 15th century, the first mention of it in writing didn't come along until 1734. in a book called, quote, The Lives and Actions of the Most Famous Highwaymen, which was printed in London under a pseudonym. Not really sure who originally wrote it. There are a few undated chapbooks that may have come out before 1734, but they definitely do not date all the way back to the 15th or even 16th centuries by any stretch. They are a lot more recent than that.
It's certainly possible that there was a cannibalistic murderer in southeastern Scotland sometime around the 15th century, and that this became the basis for the Sawney Bean legend. But given how many of the first written accounts of it were penned and published in England, it is actually a lot more likely that somebody made it up to portray Scotland as a dangerous, inbred place, just loaded with depraved killers. This may not have even been intentional. This extremely macabre story may have just captured the imaginations of writers who already thought that Scotland was not really a good place to visit.
This all kind of makes the fact that Sawney Bean has become a source of tourism dollars in Scotland today kind of a cool turnabout. It's like it was originally mentioned either to implicitly or explicitly paint Scotland as a dangerous place. Not so much anymore. Even if there wasn't a Sawney Bean or someone sort of like him living in Scotland in the 15th century, this story has been around at least since the 18th century. So it does have kind of a history of its own.
And now we're going to get to a topic that I personally love and wish we could do a real episode on, because we get a ton of requests about Mulan.
Have tried multiple times.
It is like I will try to kind of like do some research and see where any like actual hard evidence is. And it just never quite like I pull the thread and it just pulls off and is a tiny fragment of something. It's never anything substantial enough to really be a standalone episode. And it becomes also very difficult to figure out which parts of the story are true and which parts are mythology and which parts, as we've talked about in many episodes, throughout our years on this podcast, there are some where the mythology and the truth really kind of get enmeshed in a way that it is impossible to figure out what degree which of them is driving the bus.
So, the first written reference to Mulan is in the Ballad of Mulan, also known as Ode of Mulan, which is a Chinese poem from the 5th or 6th century. This poem follows the pattern of folk songs that were popular at the time, so it's definitely conceivable that there were some folk songs about this character before the poem itself was composed.
And the poem begins with Mulan weaving at a loom, and she's worried because the Khan has called for troops, and on the list of men who are required to report for duty is Mulan's father. But her father is old, and she has no older brothers, and so she wants to buy a saddle and a horse and serve in her father's place.
In the poem, she does this. She buys the horse and the saddle, as well as a bridle and a whip, and she reports for duty dressed as a boy. She serves nobly for 10 years, but when it's time for the Khan to recognize her for her achievements and offers her a promotion, she says she only wants a fast horse to take her back home.
As with Timoei Gozin, Mulan's story became incredibly popular in China in the centuries after this ballad was first composed. A whole collection of stories, songs, and tales have talked about Mulan, who dressed as a boy to serve in the army in place of her father. But there's really just not a lot of detail about who that original 5th century woman might have been, or even if she was real. We have no idea.
Nope. And I wish there were more detail, because as we've talked about before, the ladies that dress up as men to go to war, like, those tend to be some of my favorite stories.
They are, and it's a great Disney movie.
And now we're going to take another quick sponsor break before we get our last two impossible episodes. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver. And this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courtney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
Ding dong, Las Culturistas calling.
iHeart Podcast Awards 2023 Podcast of the Year, Las Culturistas, with SNL's Bowen Yang and comedian Matt Rogers.
There's stuff happening in 2024 that we really need to address.
Pop culture and huge guests, like the latest episode with
Dua Lipa.
The more I think about it, the more scared and nervous I get.
Listen to the newest episode of Las Culturistas with Dua Lipa and all episodes on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search Las Culturistas to start listening.
On our penultimate impossible episode, at around 3 o'clock in the morning on March 14th, 1964, 28-year-old Catherine Genovese, who was known as Kitty, was murdered on her way home from work at a bar in Queens, New York. And this is not apocryphal at all. That definitely really happened. She fought back against her assailant for about 40 minutes, during which time she was stabbed repeatedly and she was eventually raped. This attack ended in the vestibule of her own building.
We've had a huge uptick in requests for this one lately, and I think it's because it appeared in an episode of Girls as like a play.
It also, as I discovered as I was researching this, the perpetrator died recently.
Yeah. It's kind of been one of those things that's hovering on the edges of social conscience lately. And allegedly, the reason why people ask us to tell this story is that 37 or 38 other people stood by and did nothing while Kitty Genovese fought for and then, of course, lost her life. As reported in the New York Times on March 27, 1964, quote, for more than half an hour, 38 respectable, law-abiding citizens in Queens watched a killer stalk and stab a woman in 3 separate attacks in Kew Gardens. And according to the New York Times, the reason for 3 separate attacks was that twice someone, hearing a commotion outside, turned on a light, which scared the perpetrator away. And according to that same New York Times article, it was only when the ambulance came that people actually came out of their homes.
Winston Mosley, who was captured a few days later during a burglary, confessed to the crime, as well as the murders and sexual assaults of 2 other women in New York. He was ultimately tried only for his crimes against Genovese, for which he was convicted after a second trial. The first one actually ended up in a hung jury. As we noted a moment ago, he spent almost 52 years in prison, and he died in April of 2016 at the age of 81.
back in the 1960s, this murder led to a lot of research and discussion about whether ordinary citizens are morally or legally obligated to report crimes. And it also led to a lot of research into the bystander effect. So this is the idea that people are less likely to help when there are other people around. Basically, they think that one of those other people has already taken care of the situation. And the bystander effect, also known as the diffusion of responsibility, is also a real thing, just as this murder was a very real thing.
Yeah, I know I personally have been, say, driving down a busy highway and I see someone trying to change a car by the side of the road. Like, people are a lot less likely to stop if there are lots of people on the highway than if it's fairly deserted and you're thinking that person might not get help from someone else. Like, this is a real phenomenon that definitely exists.
Oh, yeah.
The case also spawned a number of places to start adopting Good Samaritan laws, and it was one of the factors that led to the adoption of 911 as an emergency number.
However, this number of 37 or 38 people, which is included with just about every single mention of Kitty Genovese and is the thing that people remember most about this case, was actually greatly exaggerated. It apparently came from a casual conversation between the police commissioner and a journalist, and it was meant to simply be an estimate of how many witnesses the police had interviewed, not an estimate of how many people had failed to act. The actual number of interviewees seems to be 49, not 37 or 38, but that would have included people who had absolutely no information to share because they weren't at home or they didn't wake up from the noise.
In the words of researchers who thoroughly reviewed all of the evidence and then published their findings in the journal American Psychologist in 2007, quote, using archive material, the authors show that there is no evidence for the presence of 38 witnesses or that witnesses observed the murder or that witnesses remained inactive.
Some of those people who were interviewed also thought that what they were hearing was a domestic dispute and that it just simply wasn't their business. Others didn't think there was much of a point in calling the police since in those pre-911 years, there really wasn't a central dispatch or a way of handling emergency calls, so police response was not super consistent. The 60s was also an era, particularly I think in Queens, New York, of people simply not trusting the police as a general rule.
Yeah, there was a lot of tension between police and citizenry at that time. And there were definitely people who were interviewed who were like, well, I saw something that was happening, but I didn't want to get involved. But there were also the person who eventually was there when Kitty Genovese actually died was somebody who left her apartment to go to help, not even knowing if the killer was still there. So the whole way that it's framed as the entirety of Queens literally did not care. Like, that is a huge exaggeration and not actually true. but it's definitely the reason that people ask to talk about her and the reason that the case is still remembered today. Our last impossible thing is actually one that makes me a little bit sad to debunk. It's been a while since we've gotten a request for this one. Although I was surprised that we didn't get a new wave of them after our recent episode on knitting, although we did get some requests to talk about quilting in general, and that's the idea that quilts were used as codes by the Underground Railroad.
Yeah, that idea was actually popularized in the book Hidden in Plain View, A Secret Story of Quilts and the Underground Railroad by Jacqueline Tobin and Raymond Dobard, which came out in 1998. And since then, the idea of quilt codes made its way into lots of children's books, it's in quilting books, and even in interpretive displays in museums and in craft centers. It shows up on government websites, just lots of places.
Yeah, it's presented as absolute fact in many places that you would think of as a reputable place for facts, like museums. So we want to make something really clear. I mean, enormously clear right up front. Quilting was definitely a really important craft among enslaved women. And a lot of quilting history has really ignored the contributions of black women, both free and enslaved. Pre-Civil War white women sometimes get the credit for beautiful quilts that were actually pieced and stitched by enslaved women for them. Scholarly examinations of African motifs and symbols in African American quilts are actually quite recent, considering the greater history of quilting as a whole, which for a long time was really focused on white quilters and not black quilters. I was actually at a museum exhibition about quilts, and there was literally a quilt, one quilt in the whole thing by an African-American person. And the sign at that quilt, it infuriated me because it basically was like, black people made quilts too. They were a lot like the quilts of white people. And that, like, was all that they had to say about that. And that was the only representation of, like, African influence on quilting or African-American quilters in the entire thing. I found it enormously frustrating.
Yeah. So the idea, though, that the quilts were codes for the Underground Railroad, unfortunately, hasn't really held up to scholarly scrutiny. Dobart and Tobin's source was Ozella McDaniel Williams, who was a quilter and a descendant of enslaved women, who related the story of how her ancestors would use quilts to plan and coordinate escapes. And according to Williams' description, a woman would make a sampler that would include all 10 patterns used in the code, which the other enslaved people on the plantation could use to memorize those codes.
The next step after making this sampler was to make 10 full-sized quilts, one for each of the 10 patterns. When the full-sized quilt was hung up for people to see it, it was time to take whatever step was encoded in its pattern. The next step in this whole process was to make 10 full-sized quilts, one full quilt for each of the patterns that was used in the sampler. When the full-sized quilt would be hung up, it was time to take whatever step was represented by that pattern. Some of these were actions to be taken before escaping the plantation, like a monkey wrench pattern was meant to gather up your tools. There was a basket pattern, which was meant to gather enough supplies for a long journey. There was also a wagon wheel, which either meant to load the wagon or actually prepare to leave, depending on who you talk to. Others in these patterns were information to be followed along the way, like a North Star pattern meant to follow the North Star, and a sailboat meant to take a boat across the Great Lakes.
It's such a cool concept, but there are just so many unanswered questions about this whole idea. Ozella McDaniel Williams has passed away in the years since that book was published, and there aren't any other oral history testimonies that survive to confirm her account. There are no written records or references to coded quilts in slave narratives or in interviews conducted with people who had previously been enslaved. And there are also none in the remembrances or documents of people who worked along the Underground Railroad. There are also no actual quilts surviving today, at least none that anyone has found.
Yeah, there are definitely quilts that use these patterns, but not ones that date all the way back to before the Civil War. The book's authors and other people who have written in support of this idea point out that a lot of the people making and using these quilts wouldn't have been literate, and that the quilts themselves would have been used as bed coverings until the end of their useful life, which explains both the lack of written records and the lack of quilts as physical artifacts.
But there are a lot of practical questions as well. The late historian Giles R. Wright pointed out a number of ways in which the instructions purportedly outlined in the quilts were completely different from established scholarship on the Underground Railroad, including that enslaved people in South Carolina who escaped via the Underground Railroad generally went northeast, not toward Cleveland, as would have been directed in the quilt blocks.
Yeah, these blocks purportedly originated from a South Carolina plantation. And in addition to that, it takes a long time to make a full-sized quilt. And this system purportedly required 10 full-sized quilts plus the sampler, which really would have been a huge and time-consuming undertaking, even if a plantation's enslaved women essentially held quilting bees after their other work was done. This really seems like an extraordinary and kind of convoluted and counterproductive amount of time and effort to put toward documenting very simple instructions like gather your tools and load up the wagons.
In a 2007 Time magazine article, Tobin said, quote, "It's frustrating to be attacked and not allowed to celebrate this amazing oral story of one family's experience. Whether or not it's completely valid, I have no idea, but it makes sense with the amount of research we did."
My personal feeling on the matter is that Ozella McDaniel Williams' ancestors probably really were making quilts. And they were probably using patterns and blocks that contained motifs that were related to freedom and escape. But that these family stories kind of morphed over the years to become that they were literally codes for the Underground Railroad, and that that part probably didn't happen. It really wouldn't surprise me at all, though, if her ancestors were making quilts that were sort of imbued with imagery that symbolized freedom as a form of resistance, even if they were not literally being used as tools of escape.
Yeah, it's one of those things where probably the details have morphed a little over time and gotten a little fuzzy and taken on different meanings than their original reality.
Yeah, it sort of ties to the idea that, like, most of the enslaved people and possibly all of the enslaved people on the plantation would not have known how to read, which is why visual symbols were used. But that is, like, I cannot think of a visual symbol that would have taken longer to make before displaying to people, right? Like, but yeah, it's not at all to try to erase the importance, the cultural importance of quilting among enslaved women and then later on among African American cultures who have been so long overlooked in history. But that Underground Railroad part of it is not really something that can be substantiated. And it also, a lot of folks have very romanticized ideas about the Underground Railroad and the idea that very pretty things like quilts and songs were a big part specifically of the Underground Railroad, sort of ties to that feel-good aspect of the Underground Railroad. When
it's a great story to buy into.
Yeah, it's like singing and quilting, both very culturally important. But a lot of the songs that people have said were used by the Underground Railroad to spread codes are much more recent than that time also. So it sort of gives this this shine to the Underground Railroad that makes the whole story like the more palatable aspect of slavery, which I think it's important to have stories that are accessible to children, but a lot of adults also think that the Underground Railroad was sort of a dangerous but ultimately happy experience.
Right. Well,
along the way.
And my thing with any of those, whether it's related to something like the Underground Railroad or anything, is that because there are people who will be like, why do you want to attack that? It's a great story. But when you give credence to things that didn't happen, you're robbing the actual story of its place in history.
Yeah. I read a really interesting paper while I was researching this that was about children's literature that has drawn from this whole quilt idea, and how this literature for children, what's good about it is how it ties to the idea of like making an identity for yourself and making a world for yourself that you can be a part of, and not so much about factual information about the Underground Railroad for kids.
Right. Now that we've covered lots of things that may or may not have happened or didn't happen the way that people have always been told they did, do you have some listener mail that really and for true happened?
It really did. It really and for true happened. It is about an episode that you did the research for, but about a comment that I made during the episode, and it's from Orla. And it is response to the fact that when we were talking about carbon fiber knitting needles, which I think was actually in a listener mail about our knitting episode, I was like, why would you need that? That seems a little excessive. And so Orla writes to say, I was listening to your listener mail segment and you were wondering about the reason for carbon fiber knitting needles. There are four main materials for knitting needles these days. Wood, often bamboo for the less expensive versions, metal, acrylic, which is just becoming popular over the last few years, and carbon fiber. Depending on what you are working, knitting needles can get very small. For example, 0000 needles are 1.0 millimeters, and according to Wikipedia, the smallest size is 000000, which is 0.7 millimeters. If you're using wood or acrylic needles, they can easily break from someone holding the needles too tightly or even just carrying them in your bag between knitting sessions. But metal needles are sometimes unpleasant to work with. They are my least favorite kind of needle because as I form the stitches, my needles rub against each other and I don't like the sound. Also, different needle materials of knitting needles work better with different types of yarn. Acrylic yarn tends to stick to acrylic needles, for example. Carbon fiber has the advantage of being very tough to break, even in the smallest sizes. It also isn't as sticky with acrylic yarns. However, they tend to be more expensive and either have very sharp points in the end or have a metal tip, which can sometimes cause a bump where the carbon and metal join. And then she writes to say that basically a lot of this boils down to personal preference. She's met a lot of people that have had a lot of different preferences in terms of their needle type. So thank you so much, Orla, for answering that question. I did definitely, when I learned that people were making knitting needles out of carbon fiber, was like, that seems like a little bit of overkill for a knitting needle material. So I am glad to have more information about that. If you would like to write to us about this or any other podcast, we're at historypodcast@howstuffworks.com. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/MissedInHistory and on Twitter at MissedInHistory. Our Tumblr is at missedinhistory.tumblr.com or also on Pinterest at pinterest.com/MissedInHistory. Our Instagram is MissedInHistory. If you want to come to our parent company's website, which is howstuffworks.com, you will find all kinds of information about all kinds of fascinating stuff. And if you want to come to our website, which is missedinhistory.com, that is where you will find show notes for all of the episodes we have ever done. We've had a couple people write recently to say that they were not able to find them. You can also find them by Googling Stuff You Missed in History Class show notes. You can also find a lot of other random stuff that we put up from time to time on our website. So that's at howstuffworks.com or missedinhistory.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. This is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200 percenters. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more. Then every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio, Season 9.
Love at first listen.
We're older, we're wiser, and we're podcasting through a new decade of our lives.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
And getting to the heart of our stories.
We're going places we've never gone before, and we're bringing you along with us.
With new segments, correspondence, and a brand new sound.
Season 9 is kicking off with an intimate interview with Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Natalia Lafourcade. What's giving you hope right now?
Well, when I see what music does to people, it gives me a lot of hope.
If you liked Locatora before, you're gonna love Season 9.
Subscribe to our show and you'll see why Locatora is your prima's favorite podcast.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Dura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.